Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, Guy.
Nice to see you after such a long time. Since we were on the train together back from... Oh, God, I can't remember now.
Where did we play? Plymouth. We're off again tonight.
Yes, and we are off again tonight, but today we're speaking to someone who needs no introduction, although we will give him one because this is literally an introduction.
Mr. Kenny Jones. Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot to get through, actually, because he's been part of three major groups. Small Faces, Steve Marriott and that whole mod scene, and then The Faces, Faces.
Yeah, that's the thing, Faces. And there's actually a copy of that first album with Small Faces on it, isn't there?
In America, yeah. They didn't want to release it as Faces, did they? I've always called them The Faces, but...
Yeah, they are The Faces. They're The Faces.
But I mean, look, I've got a copy of A Nod's As Good As A Wink's that right there, and it says Faces. And that's what they were. And then The Who.
Yeah.
And I actually sat on a helicopter with Kenny to go to Live Aid.
Oh, well, there you go.
He would have forgotten that probably by now. Yeah, and the amount of helicopters he gets on.
And then loads of stuff. I mean, he was always, he's clearly very popular, very liked as a drummer. He's played on loads of things for loads of people.
Yeah. But, you know, it's going to be some interesting stuff, you know, because he was also playing with Rod during that whole period where Rod had Faces and his solo stuff going at the same time, which led to all kinds of sort of fractures within the band. But we'll ask him. He's just got off his horse, I'm sure.
Exactly.
It's Kenny Jones.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
How are you doing?
Hey, Kenny. We weren't sure.
Good, Kenny.
You're getting nervous.
Yeah, I know. So was I. I couldn't get work the bloody computer. Oh. And everyone's out, so there you go.
Can we get to see your face, do you reckon, if you...
Yeah, I'm going to try and figure out how to do that now. Oh, there you go.
Yay!
We're on.
We're away.
Look at that.
Who wants to see my rotten face anyway?
That had some small face.
There you go. Can't get away from that small face.
Where are you?
Who'd want to?
I'm in my little office in the house, trying to wake up, really.
Yeah, thanks for seeing us so early. We're in the middle of a tour, Guy and I.
Are you really? Oh, great.
Yeah, with someone you know, actually.
Who's that?
Nick Mason.
Oh, great. Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, we're just about to go off to Europe.
I've seen a couple of gigs you've done. It's really good. Really, really good.
Oh,
thank you.
Really enjoyed it.
Nick says to send his very, very best. He said you're always, whenever there's any charity thing or anything that needs doing, you're always one of the first to kind of pop up. You're very good like that.
Yeah, it's great. It's nice to do something nice, you know.
And, you know, Nick, I mean, I think it's public knowledge, Nick's 78, and he's out on the road. He's just about to do 9 weeks in Europe, and he's playing like a demon.
Yeah, good. I mean, that's all you need is a little bit of practice. When you had to stop playing, I don't like stopping playing. I hate days off because basically all your muscles go and you kind of just get out of shape really quickly.
Yeah. Are you playing all the time? Do you play a lot, Kenny, still? Do you? Every day, if you're not working.
I get lazy as I get older, you see what I mean? So I kind of, you know, when they say we're a keyboard player, you know, it just says, all I have to do is run my fingers across the keys, and that's good enough for me. I sit behind a drum kit and I go, oh, this look good.
This looks like
I have a bust of Tom's, and there you go.
That's hard work. I was speaking to Matt Clifford recently, and I saw something on the internet. But you've been, it's possibility of some new recordings from Faces.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're really excited. We've recorded some. Ronnie Wood and I have recorded about 12 songs. Rod sang on 6 of them so far.
That's
fantastic.
Amazing.
Who's playing bass?
Ronnie at the moment, because what we do is Ronnie and I just put down the guitar and drums like we used to, and then Ronnie comes in, puts a bass on, and we just build it like that.
And has Matt been working on the key?
If you're stuck, you know, I'm just...
we're always stuck, you know.
Has Matt Clifford been playing keys?
Yes, he has. He plays great words as well. Really great words.
Oh, amazing. I mean, listen, could you just clear something up for me, Kenny? Because we were talking about this earlier. Is it Faces or The Faces? What do you say?
Well, you can take it either way, can't you? It's basically Faces. I used to drive Mac.
No!
I used to drive Mac nuts. Because he always says, it's Faces. And I said, well, it's The Faces and The Faces.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about your early days. Let's talk about that man that you just mentioned. Well, actually, funny enough, he wasn't in the band, was he, when you first started? It was Jimmy Winston.
Jimmy Winston, yeah. Jimmy Langworth is his real name, and he changed to Jimmy Winston. And it's only because his dad had a mum and dad had a pub that we used to rehearse him, so we could use that. So we had to get him in the band.
Oh, so it's one of those, because I always wonder, there's in every band, there's a guy who's sort of sitting in his castle or whatever, and he knows it's because he had a van.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like our percussion player at the moment, right, Nick, he's great. He's fantastic. He's good. He's good. He's got a helicopter, so... So he's definitely in the band.
Same sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah,
but Kenny, you grew up in the East End. Was it Whitechapel?
No, Stepney.
Oh, Stepney.
Between Commercial Road and Cable Street.
What's your dad do? Was there music in your family?
No. My dad was a lorry driver, typical sort of delivering. I grew up on Argentinian beef, which he used to nick, and bananas.
Oh, that famous old East End diet of Argentinian beef and bananas.
Exactly, and his brother, Uncle Jim, used to work delivering tea and tea chests, gravy tea chests. So used to get loads of tea, you know, loads of it, stuff, anything like, off the back of a lorry.
And this is when everyone else has got rationing and you just got a house full of beef and bananas.
Exactly, yeah, I was a kid, I didn't know any better, did I?
Actually, one thing, Kenny, it's a tiny little point, but Kenny with two E's.
Yeah, because basically...
What's that about?
Basically, what it was, everyone keeps asking me the same question, and because they keep pronouncing, why do you call yourself Kenny? And I go, I'm not Kenny, I'm just Kenny. But the thing is, when I joined in the 60s, when I joined the PRS, there was about three or four, maybe five Kenny Joneses, or Kenny Joneses. And I said, well, look, stick an extra E in mine, and you can separate me from the other Kennys.
Brilliant, brilliant. And what about drumming, though? How did that enter your life, Kenny?
I originally wanted to play the...
Kenny.
Kenny. No, I'm going to lose it now.
No.
I originally wanted to play the banjo. I used to clean cars with a mate of mine, every Saturday morning, and he threw the sponge, it hit me in the face, and it got my attention. He said, I think we should form a skiffle group. So I didn't want to feel sort of stupid. So I said, what's a skiffle group? And he said, well, you get your mum's...
T-chest.
No, you get a T-chest.
T-chest.
Put a broom hand in
there. Washboard.
And a washboard.
And a washboard. And fimbles. You get your grand's fimbles on your end of your fingers, and you rub up against the washboard. By this time, once he explained the T-chest and all that shit, and it makes a bass sound, I thought it was nuts. He said, there's a skiffle group coming on the TV tonight. We only just got a TV, right? And it was, we went back to watch it, and it was Lonnie Donegan came on.
Right.
Singing Rock Island Line. Rock Island Line?
So, yeah, you got it in one. It was singing Rock on the Line. I fell in love with the song. I fell in love with the banjo. I fell in love with the sound. I just loved it. I just thought it was great. And I remember seeing a banjo for sale next to Bethnal Green Station in a pawn shop. And just, we went there, and the banjo had gone. So I said to the guy, where's the banjo? He said, it's gone. The guy's played his money. He's taken his banjo. I said, well, get it back. He said, I can't get it back. I said, well, look, you know, what am I going to do? So my mate said, I've got a friend who's got a drum kit. I'll get him to bring it around this afternoon. So he brought it around that afternoon. And it turned out to be not a drum kit. It turned out to be a floor tom-tom, a bass drum, and two sticks. And one stick was broken in half. So we tried to glue it, which is impossible. Spent a couple of hours doing that. Then, so I learned to play on one and a half sticks.
You must have thought many times, what would have happened if that banjo had still been there?
Yes, I could have been.
Where would you be now?
Playing with Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. He would have been.
Oh, I'd have been the best banjo player in the world. I used to love George Formby. So when I was a kid, all the black and white films. George Formby was When I'm Cleaning Windows.
When I'm Cleaning Windows.
Yeah. I eventually bought myself a banjo years later when I joined the Who. I thought, I've got to buy myself a banjo. It's just get it out of my system. I ended up buying the wrong banjo. I bought instead of the George Formby one, a little short one, I bought a long neck one, which is 5-string.
Oh, is that with the string that ends halfway up?
That's it, got it, yeah.
Yeah.
It looks fantastic. It's mother of pearl. Yeah. I just hang on the wall just to remind me.
It's more American. But when did you meet the others? I mean, when did people like Steve come into your life and Jimmy Winston and Ronnie?
In the East End, there was only one music shop, which is where I bought my first drum kit, a little white Olympic set.
Oh, the Bar 60 or something?
The J60s in Manor Park, Green Lane. Yeah. And Ronnie Lane used to live at the top of that road. And Ronnie, when I first met Ronnie, I'm cutting a long story short here, when I first met Ronnie...
You don't have to.
Okay, I'll tell you. I was teaching myself how to play drums. After about 3 months, I heard about this... jazz band that were playing in a pub called the British Prince in the East End in Stepney. So I went up there and I sat in front of this guy, the drummer. And it's like pretending I was old enough to drink. And I looked all every bit of 12, but I had a suit on, see, so it made me look older.
Is it three-button hand-me-down?
Probably. Big shoulders. So I was just sitting there watching the drummer, and his name was Roy. And... He'd play and he'd sing as well. He had a Reslow mic that came up between his legs and sang like that, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've never seen a singing drummer playing the drums around the microphone like that, you know. So I just watched him a couple of times just to see what, picking something up, you know, little fills and stuff. And the guy, he came over to me after when I had a break, and he said to me, "You taking a piss?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you keep blinking at me." I said, "Oh," I said, "that's because you, when you play, you go, oh, yeah."
He blinked his eyes.
He goes like that. Bah, 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 bah. And he said, "No, I don't." I said, "Yes, Jim." "No, I don't." So I've got to know him really quickly. Let's put it that way. And I explained what I was doing. I said, "Yeah, I'm just trying to pick up a few tips."
Blinking tips.
Exactly. So that was that. And then...
I'm picking up a few blinking tips.
Yeah. Exactly. Very good, yeah. I watched him every other week. And then one day he stopped. He said, "Right, we've got a young guy who's going to come up and play drums now." And he introduced me. And I thought, shit. Because I kept thinking... Oh, I can watch another drummer. I've never seen that before. So, and he introduced me, and I started shaking and quivering, and called me up on the drums. So I sat behind the drums, and these guys, there's three other guys in front of me, and I sat down, and I looked up, and they looked like the Giants.
Yeah.
And I went, really? I went, yeah. And so, like, one, two, three. It sounded like, wow. Everything went into slow motion suddenly. And I found myself playing. When I got over the shock of playing, and I found myself playing. I went, "Oh, great, this is really good. I really loved it. First time I've ever played with anyone." And afterwards, the barman came up to me and said, "Kenny, that was great." He said, "Really, are you in a band?" I said, "No, I'm forming one now. My brother's just bought a guitar. He's learning how to play a Gresh." And I said, "Oh, great." He said, "Shall I bring him down next week?" So the next Friday, he brought him down. And it was Ronnie Lane, walked through the door.
Wow.
Beautiful.
And he and I hit it off together, and that was it. And then Ronnie was playing lead guitar, learning how to play. It was going, sort of really learning how to play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so after a while, he got fed up with it, being the lead guitarist. He said, I want to play bass. I'm not going to do this anymore. So we went up to the same shop, J60s, and walked in there. And on a Saturday morning, the shop was getting busy. And he said, can I help? This guy came up, little cocky guy came up, said, can I help? So yeah, he wants to try our bass out. So he said, well, come with me, I'll show you a couple of basses. And I noticed a drum kit set up on the side there. So I sit behind that, so I started to play it. And this guy was showing Ronnie these basses. And then suddenly we all started playing together. This guy picked up a guitar and Ronnie started playing the bass and I started playing the drums. And of course, we were causing havoc in the shop. And the little guy in the shop, little cocky guy in the shop, was Steve Merritt.
Oh, mate. You just brought a tear to my eye.
Yeah, so it is a bit like that, yeah. And so we Ronnie and I had already formed a band called The Outcasts, and we had a gig over at the other side of Tower Bridge. And we invited Steve that evening to come join in with us.
That's a brilliant name. It's very advanced. I'm sorry, The Outcast. I mean, that could have been a punk band.
Oh, yeah, I know. The Outcast. Yeah, I mean, yes. I often wonder what happened to The Outcast.
And Steve was quite a theatrical kid, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, we should have called ourselves The Artful Dodgers, because he turned us all into our Artful Dodgers. I mean, we were little toe rags, we were.
Because he was an actor, so, wasn't he, Steve?
He was the original Oliver in Oliver.
It's amazing. And so, when did he start singing?
Well, what happened was we got to know him, and he said, I sing. And we said, well, we think we've seen you here and there in East End. And he said, oh, yeah, we would have done. So we said, well, come up and sing with us. So we invited him up to sing with the band, and he got behind a piano, an old upright piano in there. So we started playing away, rock and roll, you know. I mean, we all started joining. It was great, I've got to say. And he suddenly Steve was getting carried away, banging on the keys. And then he jumped on the piano, started with his feet, jumping up and down, broke the piano, and we all got thrown out of the pub.
Oh, my God.
So we ended up sitting outside the pub, over to our bridge, on Ronnie Lane's amplifier and my drum cases. And we looked at each other and burst out laughing. And that is the birth of the Small Faces.
Oh, wow. What were you listening to at this point? What was your kind of music bring you together music?
We were listening to a lot of Ray Charles, Jimmy McGriff. We used to smoke a little weed then in those days.
Already?
Oh, yeah. I was smoking since the age of 7.
Weed?
No, cigarette.
Yeah, it's what you did as part from the bananas and the steak. You definitely had to smoke in the East End, right? but, you know, we were talking about this, Guy and I, yesterday, about where all these records, these blues records, were suddenly, like, appearing in your lives. And I wondered, you know, who was the guy who was getting those? And who did you suggest, Guy? You said it was
Guy Stevens.
That was the man.
Yeah. It could have been Guy. It was lots of people, mainly Steve, really, because Steve had a pretty good collection. He was collecting it anyway. He had a great collection of blues songs, and we used to love the blues and stuff. So did Ronnie Lane. I only had three records that I learned to play drums to, and that was one of them was 12 Street Rag and the theme from Rawhide that my dad liked. So I learned to play drums to those.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Fantastic.
But Chicago blues was really big, wasn't it? Muddy Waters started coming.
Oh, yeah, Muddy Waters, yeah. And also, we used to go, in those days, there were blues tours in those days. And so that was great. And I think I got drumstick, yeah. Oh, no, my little granddaughter's nicked them. I'll use a pencil. So when the guy was playing drums, like, he's just playing jazz like that. And then you go, turn it around.
Spinning it around.
Yeah. It's lovely. I just love that. Just the sort of laid back feel and blues. And, you know, it's called you're playing your emotions. As I've been trying to tell people, forget all these drum machines and forget all these clicks and stuff like that. The reason we like to play the way we play and where we started, it's called feel.
Yeah.
So you're feeling your emotion. Your emotion and your feel is transferred to your feel. that's what you're playing. Your whole body is taken up with the feeling of that song and the way you play. You know the feeling.
Yeah, but that's interesting because I've never heard anyone describe feel in that way as being feeling. That's a,
and you know, the
I live my life by that.
The thing is, with your drumming, Kenny, is it's always been really super expressive. You know, it doesn't just sit still, and it's moving with the song. It respects the song.
Yeah. It's musical. It's a musical instrument rather than a time.
Well, what I do, everyone asks me, you know, what do? How do I do it? So I just play me. You know, if you can say it, you can play it.
When did Jimmy Winston come around? Because his parents owned a pub, didn't they, that you ended up playing?
Yeah, well, we were rehearsing in there one day and we had to get him to join the band so we could keep rehearsing in the pub.
Because, he was playing guitar when you made that film, didn't you? Dateline Diamonds. And he's playing guitar in that.
Yeah.
And there's a nice connection for you guy in Dateline Diamonds, isn't there, really?
Well, Kenneth Cope plays your manager.
Exactly, yeah. I know. And I was so pleased to meet him because I used to watch him on TV and he played William Tell, you see.
That's right. Well, no, because he then went on to play Marty Hopkirk in Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. Right. Well, my dad was Jeff Randall.
Oh, really? Pleased to meet you, the descendant of those days.
Yeah, but I think, was this suddenly called Small Faces? Were you mods? I mean, you know, we all know and we grow up with the myth and we look at these pictures and you are the icon of mod for us, you know, that sort of fashion youth cult.
When we were kids, when we first met each other, there was no real fashion then at all. It was the start of the early mods and Ready Steady Go was just, there's a couple of other TV shows were on. But, because we all grew up in black and white. I mean, I grew up in black and white. We all did, just after the war. So everyone wore sort of grey and black suits and, you know, that sort of thing. And everywhere you went, there was no colour in any shops or whatever. And for instance, there was a shop that I found in Aldgate East, and I noticed this red Caravelle jumper in the window. And I thought, shit, a colour. I can't believe it. So I had to save up to buy this jumper, and it was bright red. And I think it was 30 bob it cost, which was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
After a couple of weeks, I had enough money to go and buy it. I bought it. Then I thought, I got some Levi's and I bleached them, but they all went white. So I ended up with white Levi's and this red jumper. So we were kind of making it up as we went along. And every time we wore something, we go to a gig and everyone was looking the same as us.
Were you very much, because certainly, I mean, the two bands are you and The Who, right? And it's where, of course, Pete was very much trying to talk to his audience and reflect the audience. Were you, apart from the clothes, were you immersed in the mod culture or were you just a pop group or as often?
No, we kind of invented it in a sense. I mean, partly because basically when we got to meet Don Arden and he became our manager, that was in Carnaby Street. And there was only three shops in Carnaby Street in those days. One was John Stevens, and our manager's office was above John Stevens.
Wow.
There's a sign there that says Small Faces lived here. Then there was another one called a shoe shop called Toppers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Lord John.
Lord John, come on.
We ended up having accounts in all these shops because we never got any money from Don Arden. So I used to drive my little mini up there and go buy 10 shirts every day and flog them to my mates.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't that, but because this whole thing of you just getting clothes instead of money, you were managing to turn that into money.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of, yeah. So eventually the mod thing kept turned commercial and also the rag trade sort of cotton onto it, and then more shops ended up down in Carnaby Street. Then Kings Road happened, and, you know.
Who do you credit for starting that haircut, that mod, what we know as the mod haircut with us?
It's kind of backcombing, isn't it?
Yeah, the backcombing.
Steve used to do that, funny.
But was there a particular kid, a face, that you thought, you know, everyone wanted to follow at the time?
A couple of guys. I mean, it really came through the East End. There was scooters, like the Italians came over and opened up cafes everywhere, on the corner of everywhere. And there were scooters, they brought the scooters over, the Vespas and the Lambrettas. And all that. So that's how the whole mods thing started. You know, so everyone sort of very young, like you could get a motorbike license for and 16 with their place on.
Did you have a scooter, Kenny?
No, I nicked one when I was 11.
Ah, that's the best answer.
I did, yeah.
I have to try and keep some sort of angle, you know, move this story along. Don Arden finds you. Don Arden's quite famous, isn't he, as a manager?
Yeah, he was managing the Animals and the Nashville Teens.
But it was very much this old school, wasn't it? Because we now know it kind of started, I mean, Epstein to an extent, but then Peter Grant basically invented this thing of where your band or your little family in there, a thing that you protect and you nurture. Whereas Don Arden was from the school of they're just something to be fleeced and exploited, right?
Kind of, yeah. But I mean,
yeah.
When we first met him, it was like a father figure. He said, I'm going to sign you up, boys. He said, but you can either have a percentage or a wage. Which one do you want? I said, oh, we're going to go outside and have a meeting. So, blah, 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 blah. And suddenly we walked back in and said, we want both. So we want a percentage and we want a wage. And he said, we'll give you 20 quid a week each, right? Which is average man's working wage in those days. And he said, I'll give you a percentage. That was like 1.5% or something, daft like that. He said, okay, we want £60 a week each. So we got that.
Oh, you got it? Mm. Oh, that's all right.
Then after we did a few gigs, money started to come in. We said, we wanted to give our parents 20 quid a week each. So,
For doing your washing and everything.
Yeah. So all that was going on. And then suddenly he said, look, all right, boys, he said, because we said, well, what's happening to the money? He said, well, I've opened you a bank account. I'll look after your money, boys. I really will. So he said, okay, but Don. So we thought Don was looking after our money, which he did look after it, really looked after it himself. Anyway, that was it. And that was Sharon Arden. I used to know Sharon Arden and she was a little
Sharon Osbourne, yeah.
Sharon
Osbourne, yeah.
Because you unveiled the plaque to him, didn't you?
Yeah, because they said to me.
So it makes it feel like there's still some lingering affection.
There's a shop window now. Below that plaque, that's where the doorway was to go into our offices.
On Carnaby Street. You know, well, you really touched me a minute ago, Kenny, when you were saying that you wanted some money to give to your parents. Because for me, that was such a working class thing. My dad, right from my first Saturday job, in fact, from my paper round, made me give a third of whatever I earned to my mum for housekeeping.
Yeah.
And all the way...
Was your dad Don Arden?
All the way through my... you know, work with Spandau, and while I was, you know, I was always, I'd give a third of my money to my mum while I was still living at home.
That was the thing to do, even when we were in the Outcasts, the band we had, Ronnie Lane and I, we played a pub every weekend. I would earn like 15 quid, and then during the week, you know, I'd earn another tenner from doing a couple of more gigs like a town hall. So, and I used to earn like 25 quid a week in those days, just, you know, which is more than my dad earned. Mm. So I came back. I used to give my mum half the money, so for just just looking after me.
Yeah.
I mean, at what point do you actually leave home?
It's a good question, actually. I should go home one day, really. it all happened really quickly in the small faces. Before I knew it, I mean, I learned to play drums at 13 years old, but by the time we got to 15, you know, I was. I'd hit a record in the charts. What you going to do about it?
Was The Who a kind of a band that you set your sights on as being comparable to you guys?
Well, when we had NME and all the music papers had us down as rival bands and we hated each other's guts. That's what they said until we met each other. And that was it. We just ended up touring together, become great mates. It was like being in one great big band.
Yeah, well, you did that. You had that horrific Australian tour together.
Oh, God. As soon as we landed, landed in Sydney, straight into a press conference, these guys, press came out and said, right, what drugs are you on? Pete got really angry and said, oh, not any fucking drugs. Nice welcome you're giving us here. And so that was that. And they kind of hated us from the word go.
Just to go back a bit, because what's funny is because of course you end up joining The Who and there's this quite big thing about how different your drumming style is, but because if you listen to a lot of those early Small Faces records, you are actually pretty mad. You're quite Mooney-esque early on weren't you? You were quite an explosive drummer.
If you listen to the early stuff, that's just a natural way of us playing. This album that I brought out is that one of those particular gigs I was saying in Belgium.
Oh, 1966 live. Small faces. Yeah.
That, you listen to that, you see where Zeppelin's coming from.
Oh yeah, I listen to it.
Oh no, yeah, this is something we've been talking about. This, but
because it's a nice little thing here, because I know that Robert Plant was a massive Small Faces fan and followed you around everywhere. And there's a track called "You Need Loving," which is actually, funnily enough, Steve on that live album you just showed me from '66. Steve Marriott introduces it as "You Need Love." Which was the Muddy Waters track, right? So it starts off as a kind of version. But it's different. It's different, but it's kind of influenced by Muddy Waters. And "You Need Loving," the first verse of "You Need Loving" is 100% lyrically, almost musically, the first verse of "Whole Lot of Love."
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
When "Whole Lot of Love" came out, did you lot not go, hang on a minute, that's our song?
Kind of, yeah. But the thing was, it was we didn't mind really. We listened to Zeppelin as much as they kind of nicked a few ideas from us. So we took it as a compliment.
Yeah. Wow. And I suppose Muddy Waters really. Well, Willie Dixon wrote the original.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
But do you remember Robert Plant in the audience following you around us?
Well, he used to come to the gigs and he used to come backstage and he'd go, "Oh no, it's that bloke again. He's 7 foot tall."
Compared to you, yeah.
Is that Brummy? It's that tall Brummy again.
Yeah, exactly. It was great. He just always wanted to pick up a few tips here and there.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Let's talk about Ogden's Nut Gone Flake.
Yes.
Because Ogden's Nut Gone Flake.
Mate, I mean, to go into... You know, this is, you know, one of the first concept albums, or the second side of it, at least, is what you'd call a concept album. I suppose it has a story.
It's more like it's kind of like a quick one in a way, isn't it? In that you've just got a mini operetta sort of thing.
I only know one
stuck
quick
on
one.
An album.
But it's about a kid who's lost the moon or something. Is looking for the other half of the moon.
He's looking for the other half.
Were you all on acid or something, Kenny? What happened?
Many different things. But what happened was how it came about is, when we were on Immediate Records, Andrew Oldham said, "You've got to go and write some songs, guys. So I fixed you up a boat each. I fired a boat each for you on the Thames." So we ended up with a boat each. It's another story in itself. That is funny.
Why a boat each? Surely you want to be on a boat together.
We took our girlfriends with us and stuff. It's like a caravan, you know, on the sea, on the water. So we ended up having a great weekend, bashing in different boats. And I didn't understand tides and anything like that. So, you know, currents and stuff. The only current I knew was in my mum's cupboard.
With your bananas.
Yeah, bananas. Trying to turn the boat around and ended up drifting into a disused destroyer that this family were living in. I converted it into a home. And I went sailing into the side of it, into the port. I remember my face hit the port. The windscreen of the boat landed over my head. And my face was pressed up against the porthole like that. And inside was people eating their Sunday dinner. So that was my experience of being a sailor. Then Mac was, he was sailing. I was behind Mac in my boat, and then I could see this guy, this other boat coming towards Mac in his boat, and this guy was a sailboat with the sails down, and he was on the front being so proud. This guy, he was dressed in white, had a white shirt, white shoes, white socks, everything was white, and he was like this, you know. And he could see the look on his face was getting more and more concerned as Mac approached. So Mac ended up scraping down the whole side of this guy's yacht.
Oh, no.
This guy was shouting out to Mac, "Scourge of the sea, scourge of the sea."
What sort of boats were they then?
Well, they were kind of little motorboats, yeah. Like a caravan on wheels.
And somehow out of all of this, Ogden's Nut Corn Flake appeared.
I'll get there in the end. We moored up against the side of the Thames and we lit a fire and we thought we'd better write some songs. We haven't done any of it. So nothing, we'd have sat down to write some songs and couldn't think of anything. one of us, I don't know which one I said, just looked up in the moon and sort of went, "Where's the other half of the moon?" "I don't know, where's it gone?" That's how it came about. Stan was Ronnie Lane's father.
Oh,
that's his name. Yeah. So, and he was always happy. Ronnie's dad, he wasn't overweight, but he had three double chins. So, and when he laughed, he was just all sugar. He was always happy and laughing. Oh. So that's where happiness Stan came from.
Because Stanley Unwin wasn't your first choice.
Hang on, just can we just explain who Stanley Unwin is? What?
Yep.
Stanley Unwin, he talks gobbledygook and he goes, are you sitting humped about two square on your body? Then I'll begin.
Yeah. Flodio, depend for you.
Deep Joy. He's in a couple of movies, Carry On movies and stuff like
Deep
that.
Deep Joy.
He basically invented his own take on the English language.
Yeah.
It was violin and scratchy on the cat guy.
Yeah, you're 24 years old, go down the hot flow, down the garden bath floaters, and all of a sudden a big flop will come around the corner.
Yeah. And
He used to be on TV all the time when we were kids. Yeah.
So you got him to sort of do some little narration between each track, didn't you, on that second side?
Yeah, what happened was we wanted Eric Seitz to do it. And Eric Seitz wanted to do it, but he couldn't do it. He was busy. So we ended up getting Stanley Unwin in.
So did you write the lines for him and then he just turned it into his...
Well, he said when he came into the studio, he said, "Look, I just want to get to know each one of you." So we spent some time with each one of us. So you could pick up on our mannerisms and stuff like that. So, you know, blow your... We used to say, "Cool, man." This guy's blown his cool. That sort of thing. And so you go, "Blow your cool, man," and do this deep focus.
Wow. But this is an extraordinary record. And even today, people hold it up as being one of the, you know, one of the most important albums in the history of music.
Well, I love it. I love my drumming on it. I think it's great.
I mean, that opening instrumental, which is really the sort of overture, It's a phenomenal piece of work and would have influenced Pete and Tommy, surely.
Well, it was actually my tune. Because I don't play guitar, I had to hum it to everyone. No.
Because you didn't have your banjo.
I did. My banjo was nowhere near it.
Wow.
So what happened was, I mean, in those days I was doing lots of sessions for other people. A lot of people wanted me to play on their records, so I just ended up doing these big band sessions. So, and I was playing, I found myself playing on these great big fills, orchestral fills, and I really, really got into it. And I just loved these big, you know. And so when it came to doing Ogden's, I kind of took that flavour of what I learned from the studio and big planning, big bands, and sort of put my drumming style into that.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting here you say that, Kenny, is the fact that, because that's quite unusual, man. It's a great testament to you. The fact that you, because people back then, you were either a band guy or a session guy. The fact that, for a start, where did you find the time?
Well, I love playing with different people. It was also very nerve-wracking at the time as well, because I couldn't read music. My girlfriend's at that time, her father was Tony Osborne, the band leader.
Oh, okay.
And he introduced me to my very first session. He said, "But I don't read music." He said, "Yeah, you can do a session for me. I'll teach you how to read music." He said, "You can't teach me in 5 seconds flat." He said, "Yes, come out." And he'd split up with his wife by then. So he said, "Come out to my flat." So I went around to his flat. I said, "Look, show me the piece of paper you write music." He said, "Look, that's a bar. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's a bar, yeah. And that line, top line is your cymbal, and that one's down at your foot and your bass line. I said, I'm not going to pick all this up in time. He said, yeah, just concentrate. Played the song that I was going to play on the next day. And it was in Trident Studios. It just built Trident Studios in Wardour Street.
So in Soho.
I ended up below the control room. The control room was upstairs. Below the control room was the rhythm section. In the rhythm section was Herbie Flowers on bass. And Big Jim Sullivan on guitar.
Wow.
And little me sitting in between them.
Oh,
so they just saw, they were great guys. I tell you, Herbie was...
Yeah, we should point out, Big Jim Sullivan was one of the absolute great named session players.
Oh, and Herbie Flowers was as well.
But Bowie.
It's only for our audience, because I think people know Herbie Flowers because of Bowie and Lou Reed.
That's right. So they made me feel really comfortable. Then the brass section was there, the string section was over there, and all kinds of stuff, and the harps. And my father-in-law at the time, standing on the bandstand, right, boom, 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 with his stick, you know. So we're going to play it. So now... He looked at me, just gave me a wink and said, right, okay, we got to play. So we're playing away, getting to play the song. And we're playing it, and just get to this part where we go, ba, 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 ba. Boom. I was playing away, and suddenly I went, ba, 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 ba. And the whole orchestra did the same thing with me. I went, ba, ba, and I stopped playing. I went, fuck. And Tony Osborne, my father-in-law, said, what'd you stop playing for? I can't believe everyone did it at the same time as me, but no, from this little bit of paper.
From this little bit of paper. What was the song for? What was the recording for?
I don't know, something like Eartha Kitt, something like that.
But Pete asked you to play on the Tommy soundtrack, didn't he? Instead of Keith. That must have been a weird one.
Yeah, Keith was kind of that known point. For being out of it now and again. So.
And Ronnie's on Tommy as well, isn't he?
Ronnie's on
Ronnie Wood, yeah.
Yeah. So I ended up playing on Tommy in the soundtrack.
We've skipped the Faces.
I was still in the Faces when he asked me to do that.
Yeah.
But after with Ogden's Nut Gone Flake comes out, incredible cover as well. It's a round cover. I mean, everything about this is unique.
In fact, where did the title come from?
Once we finished the album, we had a little flat called in Pimlico. Everyone used to come around and smoke weed and go. Ended up looking down at this tin after figuring out what album cover we could do. So we all looked down and looked at this tin, and the lid was on the side, and the tobacco, it's called Ogden's Tobacco, pipe smoking tobacco. It was great for rolling your joints. And the packet of Rizzlers, right, which we ended up calling, turning into Sus, like, instead of calling it RZA, we call it Sus, like Sus, S-U-S, suspect.
So it was a nod to sort of taking drugs, really, the Ogden's Nut Gone Flake.
Come on, so, well, it is. So,
well, you did that a lot, didn't you? You had some pretty
appearances
in your songs. Yeah, exactly.
We took the tin. I thought, that's a great... We like the cover of the tin. So we said, okay, we'll call it Ogden's Nut Gone Flake. So when you smoke your joints, it makes your nut go.
Brilliant.
I never knew that. That's fantastic.
So that's how the album cover came about. The bit in the middle, when you open the cover, there's a medieval sort of drawing, and that was a friend of Mac who did that.
But you never got to play it live, did you? Well, not really.
Or was it once? You did it once, didn't you?
No, that was your mum into the bloody thing.
Ah. And that's what was driving Steve mad, wasn't it?
Yeah, all of us. I mean, by this time we'd had lots of commercial records out, and it was driving us nuts because we could not lose this teeny bopper image. And if you listen to, that's why I like this album so much, because of the discovery of it. Because basically, that's I often wonder what kind of music we would have turned into.
The live album, yeah.
Yes, the live album is going, which we could say, which we've both been listening to, by the way, and the energy on that is just phenomenal.
It's very much freeform. There's one title song called Oop Oopie Doo, and I don't remember. I think it's a stupid title, Oop Oopie Doo.
But it was all getting quite adventurous, because one of your last singles, The Universal, Steve recorded it in his garden on a cassette, and you could hear the dog barking and everything, couldn't you?
Funny enough, that someone just sent me that this morning when I was opening my mail, looking at it. To get onto the net with you guys.
Oh, right. But
Universal.
But what happened then with Steve leaving? What How did you feel at that point when it was, it felt like things were collapsing around you?
Well, it was a hard breakup, basically, because when it happened, none of us were really surprised, but we were surprised in the way that Steve did it. We were at Alexandra Palace, and I think it was New Year's Eve, something like that. And Steve just threw his guitar down and walked off stage and left us there.
Wow.
So, didn't he say I quit or something as he left? Yeah. But you have very much, this has been the problem with a lot of, it's a very English thing, this, because I remember Nick said the same thing in interviews with Pink Floyd, is that most problems just like this come from people just not talking to each
other.
Exactly. If you just had a chat about...
When I joined New York, I've always been jealous of bands that have stayed together, like the Stones and somewhat the Beatles and The Who. It's Genesis, really. You can overcome any problem if you talk to each other. And there's enough room in music for everyone to go off and do their solo stuff and still come back to the band.
Yeah, but in my opinion, though, Kelly, I mean, I what happened then was great for me because I ended up with two of the most fantastic bands, because I was a bit young for Small Faces. So me getting into Small Faces was in retrospect. But now, you know, my record collection, the two greatest records that I had in my collection as a kid, you know, one was Nods As Good As A Wink and the other one was Humble Pie Rocking the Fillmore. So out of that split came two fantastic bands. But you, I mean, we've got to talk about your introduction to Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood and how that happened.
When we split up, we were quite friendly with the Stones anyway, because of Immediate Records. They were in and out of the...
Andrew Lou Goldham, yeah.
They said, well, what are you going to do now? So we said, well, we're just going to get together once a week and just try and play. They said, well, we've got a place where we keep, a warehouse where we keep all our equipment in Bermondsey, in the East End. So I said, okay, great. He said, well, you can use it. We've got a soundproof room down there. So you can use it as much as you like. So we went down every week, used to get together and just go and have a jam. This went on for a couple of weeks. Until one day, Ronnie Lane brought down his new next-door neighbour, and that was Ronnie Wood when he came in.
Who was in the Jeff Beck group, right?
Wow. Playing bass.
He was in the Jeff Beck.
Playing bass.
Playing bass.
Yeah.
And I've got to tell you, Woody is a fantastic bass player.
Yeah.
So he was learning to play, not learning to play, he was just converting to guitar. So he was playing guitar and stuff like that. And then suddenly, a couple of weeks later, Ronnie Wood brought down his one of his best mates, and that was Rod Stewart. So Rod used to sit on the amps waiting for us to go up the pub.
And had you never come across Rod before, so on the scene in his old R&B?
Yeah, because I'd occasionally pass him on the stairs going in and out of Immediate Records. So I knew he had a good
voice.
He
was a North London boy, wasn't he? And he was a bit long.
He was also singing in the Jeff Beck band as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. And incredibly shy back then, wasn't he? Like hiding behind the amps or literally even being
on stage. But still, seriously, one of the most amazing dresser, wasn't he? I mean, incredible face.
No, he's always a good dresser. They called him Rod the Mod.
That's right, yeah.
Do you remember that first song you played together with Ronnie on guitar and Rod singing?
Not really. I think it's more like just a jam of bluesy sort of stuff.
Right.
Because what I remember is I was sitting there with my critical hound. Being a drummer, you've got the best seat in the house, you know. I'm sitting there playing, and I watch everything going on. And suddenly I said, look, we've got to take this serious. I said, you know, you've got to start singing. Someone's got to start singing. I know Ronnie had a great voice, Ronnie Lane.
Yeah.
Right. Ronnie sang, and it's always a beautiful sound in his voice, you know. Very emotional.
Yeah.
And then Max started singing, and I went, and then Ronnie Wood started to sing, and and all the time I'm looking at Rod sitting on the amps. Then we had a break and went up the pub. It was called the Bermondsey Arms in Bermondsey Street, and we was going to the pub in there. So when we walked in there, I said, Rod, I did an Adam Faithful now. Got him around the shoulder. I said, can I have a word with you in another bar? I said, yeah, okay, great. So we're in another bar.
Fancy a drink?
Fancy a drink?
Exactly.
And I said, do you fancy joining the band? And he went, I said, do you think everyone would let me? I said, yeah, of course I. And that evening, Alvin Lee was having a little smoking, drinking party around in his muse flat, back of Arlen Street. So we went back there to his place and sort of having a drink and whatever. And I said to the rest of the band, can I have a word with everyone upstairs? So I went upstairs with everyone. I said, look, I've asked Ron to join the band. And all of a sudden I got back. Oh, we don't want another prima donna. We don't want another Steve Marriott walking out on us and stuff like that. Oh, fucking hell. This went on forever. So I just stood my ground and went, fuck it. I knew it was a difference, personally, I knew it was a difference between success and failure from my point of view. And also, I was waiting, when you've that powerful voice of working with Steve all the time, you're going to miss it.
Yeah.
We're a new band, so we go anywhere we like, you know. So that's how we started.
Yeah, but
so,
they were sort of right and wrong, weren't they, Kenny? Because obviously they were wrong because because Faces became one of the greatest rock bands of all time, and still to this day, I hold them as one of top five favourite all-time records, and is not as good as a wink. But also, Rod had this other job. He was making a solo record, and you were playing on his solo records, and he was always thinking, am I going to go solo? Am I not going to go solo? So, and there was a sense that eventually he did have to walk, he did walk out.
I put it down to Brett Eklund, really.
Right, okay, but it was an amazing time, wasn't it? Because you're making records for the Faces, and you're also making Rod's solo records, weren't you?
Oh, it's a plan, both of them, in a sense.
Yeah,
I remember one time in the Faces. So Rod called up and said, "Kenny, you know that song we do in when we play live, Losing You?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm recording it now. Can you come and play on it?" I said, "Yeah, no problem." I remember watching a film at the time. I got in my car straight away, was in Wilson Lane, 2 seconds flat, really. And then I'm sitting behind Mickey Wallace drum kit, playing away, and I did Losing You. I recorded it.
Wow.
I said, see you later, but I went back to, and when I got home, I watched the other half of the film.
What was the film?
I can't wait for my memo. No, it wasn't called that, but it's a good time.
But did you play on all the sort of Every Picture Tells a Story, or was that
a couple of tracks on each one? Yeah.
Right. So, was there a frustration that maybe this was you were kind of being seen as Rod's backing group at one point?
No, at that time, no, because basically what happened was when we ended up getting a deal with Warner Brothers as a new band. So, and I remember my accountant said to me once when the Small Faces split, he said, what are you going to do now? I said, well, we've got to get a new record deal. He said, we'll get an advance and we'll just carry on. He went, how much do you think you're going to get? I said, I don't know why, but £30,000 came into my mind. He said, £30,000? And he went, telephone numbers. So this accountant, right? Fuck. So when we ended up doing it, I'm sorry, it's a long way around to say it. We ended up getting a deal with Warner Brothers, and Billy Gaff, who became our manager, said, how much do you think I should ask for? I said, £30,000, and not a penny more, and not a penny less. So, I ended up getting 30,000 quid. It's a lot of money in those days. 1969.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
a lot.
And so, then it came to signing on the dotted line. You know, and the boss of the record company that was a guy called Ian Ralphini. We just got to sign on the dotted line. And I went, hold on a minute. It says Small Faces here. So I don't know what we're going to call our band. You know, I said, because it's a new band. Nothing like the Small Faces. He said, well, you're a known band. So we've signed you as a Small Faces. He said, in other words, he said, if you don't call yourselves a Small Faces, you can't have any of this money.
Right.
So all of a sudden I went, fuck it. We want the money. We're all broke. We agreed to that, Dad. We said, we'll call the album, the first album, Small Faces, but thereafter, we're going to call it, there's nothing small about us at all, so we're going to chop the small off, and it's going to be, we're going to be Faces. That's how the Faces name got, which is actually, in a funny sort of way, couldn't have been a better name for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think about Small Faces when I think about Faces, two different bands.
No, because the Faces just had that brilliant thing of, even though the Small Faces were such a fantastic entity, but the Faces felt like this ultimate gang 100%. Who'd been together forever.
100%. You know? I mean, they were a massive influence on the way we wanted to perform live in the 80s in my band. You know, it was this sort of fall about camaraderie, having a massive laugh, dangerous, if you like, but never taking the music so seriously that it was merely about having fun, wasn't it? Was it chaotic? Did it feel like that?
It,
We used to throw bottles of wine to the audience.
When the Proovers get together, it's still chaotic. So we haven't lost our magic, you know. But the thing is, it was like a gig was, it wasn't like doing a gig. It was going to a gig, which is pleasurable, which is not, it wasn't a chore. It was like, we all had a drink before we went on stage, so we all laughed fucking cut anyway. And the audience had booze. It's in those days, the audience would bring booze and do it. And we used to give them bottles of wine.
And you used to kick footballs out, didn't you? Kick footballs out. I
mean, the audience might as have been on stage and we might as have been in the audience. It's just one of those great big communal parties.
I mean, you get a feeling that Britpop and all that Oasis stuff, none of that would have existed if it wasn't for the Faces.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, do you remember Stay With Me coming in as a song? Because, you know, that was such an important song for me as a kid.
Yeah. We did it at Olympic Studios. Glenn Johns was the engineer.
Glenn goes all the way back with you, though, doesn't he?
For me, he does, yeah. Even though the sessions I used to do, Glenn was always probably one of the engineers that was mostly there. Very well sought after. And he was a great engineer. Just superb. I saw Glenn about... I see quite a lot of it. I saw him, but one of the... things I had to ask him about 3 years ago. I said, Glenn, so I finished doing my book, you know. I said, everyone keeps asking me how I got my drum sound. Did you mic me two overhead mics? I remember that. He said, no, just one overhead mic. And he said, I just close mic the snare. That's it. I said, well, how'd you get my sound then? He said, it's you silly. So I just captured the, I just captured the room sound of the Olympics, because that big IC.
Yeah, it is a live sound. It is a really live drum sound. I think that's what adds to the raucous sort of fun of it all.
It's the ambient sound. I'm a great believer in capturing the drums, you know, the ambient sound that the drums make in a room.
I totally agree. I think people have got way too precious about the whole drum miking thing.
That's right. Yeah. You ended up sort of getting a drum sound, and you got what used to drive me nuts with certain engineers. I ended up with a great sort of snare sound, like a snare should sound. Then I'll get your drum sound. I ended up sounding like this. Yeah, fuck, it's terrible. Like sounding like a cardboard box.
Kenny, was there a sense that it was like deja vu, that it was all happening again when Rod and the Ronnie's starts to slip away? Ronnie Lane gets pissed off and leaves. And
Rod said, you know, a couple of times to me, he said, well, you know, so funny enough, he said, when Ronnie Lane left the band and we continued with Tetsu, something happened to the Faces, the spirit of the band went when Ronnie Lane left. And he's right.
Kenny, I need to get to you, you know, joining The Who, really, and I'm pushing it that way. Sorry, I apologise. Yeah. But I'm going to go back and ask that same question. Was there a sense of disappointment for you when Rod went, you know what, I'm just not going to do any more with the Faces?
No, what it was kind of, we'd, on the last tour, Ronnie Wood called us and said, look, he said, Mick Taylor's left the Stones, and Mick Jagger's asked me to stand in whilst they find a guitarist for someone. So he said, Ronnie, no, you go and do it with this tour. I said, but keep yourself together, because our tour starts in Miami exactly when you finish. So just make sure you're ready for that. So I went over to Miami and we rehearsed over there. Woody came back. He came back more Rolling Stone than a Face.
Right.
No. So Rod and I looked at each other and went, yeah, writing's on the wall here. So we knew straight away. So Rod and I started a band together. We put a band together, and it had Billy Peak on guitar, Phil Chen on bass, and Gary... God, I forget his name now.
Granger. Yes.
And he was a great guitar.
Well done, guy.
So, great. I love your memory. I don't like mine. But we ended up putting a band together, and it sounded fantastic, because Billy Peak on guitar was great. And with Gary Granger, the unit clicked. And Rod just, you know, singing away there. And I remember Rod saying to me, yeah, I've never heard you play like that. So I said, well, I do lots of sessions in between. It's a different band. We had to go to LA to rehearse and as a new band. Not Rod Stewart and Summit, it was a new band. I was an equal member of that band, you know. And in the end, I got cold feet. I remember the truck coming around picking up my flight cases to take to Heathrow Airport. In the end, I thought, I don't like the idea of this. I was staying away for 3 months and I'm not sure in my heart I want to do this. So I called up Billy Gaffer, our manager at the time. I said, look, Billy, I said, I've got cold feet. I don't really want to do it. I said, I do want to do it, but I feel disloyal to the fans that we've already got. He said, okay. So anyway, I put the phone down and spoke to Rod and said, yeah, he said, don't worry, Kenny, it's fine, come on. I ended up going to get my drum flight cases back from Heathrow that evening, pulled them out. And then I kept doing sessions after that, just playing away. And then I was forming a band with Glyn Johns for Atlantic Records, and it was half American and half English. We were playing away, and I found myself going one of the trips with the band. I went to America to meet everyone and do that, whatever. I don't know, I had to fly back to England because they lived in Texas. And so it's kind of half English, half American, half Eagle, half East End, if you say.
Right.
Paul McCartney was producing this film called Buddy Holly Film. So I was invited to that. As soon as I got off a plane, I found myself in a car, straight from the airport, straight to this premiere. But it's kind of weird. The premiere was, you know, the after party of the premiere. Paul had the party before.
Right.
At Peppermint Park.
Peppermint Park, yeah. And so we ended up going to Peppermint Park, and I found myself on a table there with Paul and Linda, Keith and his girlfriend.
Keith Moon,
yeah. Mm. And his girlfriend. And
Annette.
Yeah, Annette. And David Frost, before he was a sir, Paul's brother from the scaffold.
Mike.
Oh, yeah. Mike.
Keith said to me, how you been? What are you doing? I said, I told him about the band I was doing. He said, yeah, great. He said, fantastic. I said, how are you doing? He said, oh, I said, great. I said, I don't take any drugs. And and they used to drink like a fish. And I said, oh, no, I don't drink anymore. He said, doctors give me these pills. If I dare ever drink when I'm taking these pills, he said, I'll get violently ill and sick. So I said, oh, okay. That was the conversation, basically. Then we all walked around to the Leicester Square Odeon for the premiere of the film, watched the film. And after the film, came outside, said goodbye to each other. I could see you later. Bye. I went home I lived in Amsterdam, went to sleep, woke up the next day. You know when you wake up, you turn the TV on, the news came on, and it said, Keith Moon was found dead in his flat today of a drug overdose. I thought, it can't be true, it just can't be. I just left him. It's called, he's done another practical joke. That was that, and it ended up being true, of course.
But it was the drugs that were meant to save him, wasn't it? That was the thing.
I found out once I joined her, which is another story in itself, I found out that he died of a drug overdose, but it was accidental. He'd gone back to the flat, taken his nighttime pill, and woke up a couple of hours later thinking it was morning, and took another pill. Oh. And apparently, if you take those pills close together, it slows your heart down. So you end up dying because of that kind of overdose.
Yeah, well, they found a load in his stomach. But apparently, it's kind of like Michael Jackson. It's the sort of drug that needs to be administered. It's not something you just give a bottle to, especially someone like Keith, you know.
How proud were you when you took over from Keith in The Who?
Well, it's kind of strange because I never really took over from him. Because when I joined, what happened was I got a call from Bill Gibbsy. So, Kenny, so I'll come straight.
The Who's manager.
So I'll come straight to the point. The Who have had a meeting and they want you to join the band and not thinking about anyone else. So I said, well, it's very kind, Bill. I said, very flattering. I said, but it's, I said, I can't, sorry. He went, what do you mean? You can't. So I could hear his chin drop on the floor. So he said, look, Pete's coming into the office a bit later on. Do you want to come and have a chat? I said, yeah, I'd always happily see Pete. So that evening I went to Warner Street and just said hello to Pete. We ended up having a chat, me, Bill and Pete, just talking about the old times of touring, stuff like that. And then, he said to me, you've got to join the band. You're one of us. You're a mod. You come through the ranks with us.
You're a mod. You're a mod. I love that.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's quite funny. Right. And so I said, look, my band by chance is in town, the American side, in town today. So I'm going to see him after this. So I said, I'll chat through with my band, see what they say. I went back to my band and I said, look, something said, I said, Who have had a meeting? Who have asked me to join them in the band? And they said, well, Kenny, you've got to do it. And they said, graciously, I said, well, thank you very much for your understanding. And they said, no, you've got to do it. So that was it. I ended up joining The Who. But I did say in that meeting, if I join, I'm not replacing Keith Moon. I'm not copying Keith at all. I'm a completely different drummer. There's only one drummer for The Who. There always will be only one drummer for The Who, and that's Keith Moon.
But you did two great albums with The Who. You did Face Dances and It's Hard, you know, with some fantastic tracks.
And you did, I remember seeing you at Wembley Stadium when you did that.
Yeah, I remember seeing you.
First show.
Yeah, no,
but, and also, I flew in, I don't know if you remember, Kenny, but we shared a helicopter, I think, with going to Live Aid in 85.
Yeah, because that's funny, because I flew myself, I learned to fly a helicopter a couple of years before. So I flew myself into Battersea Heliport and parked the helicopter up. And of course, the pilots saw me land. I said, do you want to come and co-pilot the Live Aid 1 or 2? They had two big helicopters, massive ones. I said, well, okay, yeah, no problem. So get in there, sit there. And yeah, you're in the helicopter as well?
Yeah, yeah, Spandau Ballet were in the helicopter, yeah, yeah.
And what I did was I got back into the helicopter, co-piloted that back to Battersea, got in my helicopter and flew back home and watched it on TV.
Was it Noel Edmonds in that helicopter? It was one of those helicopters, was it?
It was his helicopter that I was converting to at the time. That was...
Well, he flies as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, that was called a squirrel.
No, but I remember talking with Pete backstage at Live Aid and, you know, so excited that The Who were going to play, because he hadn't played for quite a while. And I walked up onto the side of the stage with Pete, stood right next to John Entwistle's amp, which took my head off.
Which blew up.
Blew up,
which
didn't also it? Yeah, blew you had a few technical it? Problems, didn't you, on
the no, I'm fucking deaf from it now. It's funny. One of the funniest things I've seen when I was doing one of the gigs that, you know, we did, was Roger used to keep ice cream and honey on the side there so he could have a spoonful of honey or a spoonful of ice cream.
His throat.
Through his throat, yeah. And so Roger was always saying, turn it down, John, turn it down, turn it, because it's so loud. Emerson would just walk back slowly, just winked at me and walk back slowly, walk back, got all of his ice cream, mix the two things together, stirred it all up, just to piss Roger off.
Oh, my God.
But, great. It's when you're sitting... You know, when you can see everything that's going on when you're a drummer, you can see everything going on.
We can't keep you much longer. I know you've got to get off, Kenny. No.
It's been a pleasure, I can say.
Mate.
It's been actually very, very emotional talking to you, to be honest.
It's been one of the best rock on tours we've done. I mean, your stories are fantastic. Yeah. And I feel like we've only just sort of touched the surface of a lot of... I mean, we could have done a whole show about the Small Faces.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much more we could do. Because Kenny, you've been involved in so much music that is really the closest music to our hearts.
I'm glad you like what we've done so far.
There's more to come.
Keep it up, mate. Keep it up.
I can't wait to hear the new Faces stuff you're doing. I mean, is the plan to get an album out at some stage?
Yeah, the idea is we've got... It's a mixture of what Ronnie's found and I found in my collection and his collection. And so we found a couple of songs that have not been released. So we're going to put those on and rework those.
Hang on a minute. Have you actually, is some of it old demos with Mac on it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
We've got some new old stuff, you see, which is too good to pass up on. So we're playing with that at the moment.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so we've done a track called I Can Feel the Fire, which is Ronnie Wood's solo album.
Oh.
But we've done it slightly different, so lots of different little things. I don't want to say too much because, you know, these things change. And I just mentioned one song. Knowing that it'll be on there, but maybe it won't be on there.
Yeah. We'll look forward to it anyway, because absolutely, yeah. Kenny, you're...
Now you've got to send me some of your summer, that you and Nick and all that.
Yeah. Listen, let's stay in touch and... Thank you so much for doing this. It's been a total joy. What would Stanley Unwin have said?
Deep joy. Oh, you made my day. That's right. You made my morning. I'm going to go and have a cup of tea now.
Cheers, mate. Oh, Guy, that was unbelievable. Oh,
that was quite overwhelming.
He's a great storyteller, isn't he?
He's a great storyteller. I could sit with him all day. Now, that's a man who was...
I can already see our Twitter responses saying, part two, please, part two. I felt like...
Yeah. Part three?
I felt like we were sort of skimming a lot of stuff with The Who and
Yeah, we missed loads of really, really big. But to be fair, I think the stuff we were getting was not the standard interview fare, which is, of course, is our raison d'etre. So it's, you know, you can, there's all that other stuff you can get other places, but this is the, you know. Yeah. I don't know.
So we're off to Europe for 9 weeks, aren't we? Nearly 9 weeks, starting Friday.
Nearly 9 weeks, and it's a really grueling schedule. We're going to try and still keep these up as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. So keep your eye on the website, on the podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And I've got a good feeling about this. I think we're taking our little devices on the road with us, and I think we'll be able to make it work. Well, I can't wait to listen to this one back.
No, I really can't.
All right, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.